What's going on here at East Hill? And this year we are reading our way all the way through the Bible. We have gotten all the way to 2 Chronicles this week. And what I'm trying to do usually in the morning hour is to preach a sermon to kind of help fill in the blanks a little bit with regard to the things that don't get covered in our Bible class. I'm not fooling myself to think an extra 30 minutes is going to complete our understanding of the entire Bible, but maybe plug one or two little holes at least. And I wanted to spend some time here this morning talking about King Asa and the record that we have of his reign in Judah that is recorded for us in the book of 2 Chronicles, starting chapter 14, I believe it is, and going through about chapter 16. Asa is one of the kings that is a good fellow. A very good, in fact, man. One who served God, the text says, all his days. Verse number 2, chapter 14, Asa did good and right in the sight of the Lord his God, for he removed the foreign altars and high places, tore down the sacred pillars, cut down the Asherim, and commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers and to observe the law and the commandment. And in a general sense, this is how Asa lived his life. The text is quite clear with regard to that Asa, unlike some of his predecessors and unlike some of his descendants, was devoted to the things of God. But, and that's a big but that we had there on the end, Asa had a falling out of faith toward the end. And God will be the judge of such things. God will determine how he stands ultimately before God. We can certainly read the positive aspects of Asa's reign and derive some important lessons. But what I want to do here primarily this morning is talk about the negative. Talk about what went wrong in this great man's life, and especially for the purposes of keeping it from going wrong in our life, so that we can be stronger, so that we can be more faithful, and not only serve the Lord, but continue to serve the Lord in difficult times, in challenging times, in times when our faith is being directly assaulted by forces on the outside or even forces on the inside of the people of God. What could have gone wrong with this great man of faith who toward the end of his life, toward the end of his tenure, seemed, at least appeared on the surface, to take a stand in absolute opposition to everything that he'd done for his entire life? What might cause that to happen in Asa's life? What might that cause that to happen in our life? One problem, I think, is the problem of too much peace. Now, we think of peace as being a positive thing, and by and large it is. But the Bible talks about conflict as not only being an inevitable aspect of our service to God, but also to a certain extent a positive aspect. There is a way, there is a sense in which our efforts to serve God, to please God, to fight for God, has a positive impact on our faith, that it builds us up, it hones us, it strengthens us. Going through his crucible, going through his refining fire, that same image occurs over and over again, especially in the prophets. The idea of God purifying us and making us right. Oftentimes the way this happens is by sending us through challenges, difficulties, hardships, warfare, essentially. And it certainly can be the case that when we become too separated from this, when we are too successful in our efforts to serve God, we can forget what it's like to fight. And then when the opportunity comes for us to fight, we get all a twitter and we wind up abandoning our principles. That is, at least in part, I think, what happened with Asa. Asa encounters, and we discussed this briefly in the hour previous, what is, I believe, the largest army in the Bible. The invading forces from Ethiopia and other areas in Africa, what we would call Africa, come up and invade a million strong, the text says. And Asa trusted in God in this time of conflict, and God gave him the victory over an overwhelming force. Even in the modern day, we would have difficulty fighting a million soldiers, regardless of what kind of armament they might have. Sheer numbers alone are staggering. And the idea that God would give him the victory in this time clearly indicates, like it did in Gideon's day, like it did in Jonathan's day, other passages that we've read about already in the Old Testament, The idea that God can win with many or with few. It doesn't matter to God. And the faithful have always understood this, although we need to be reminded every once in a while, that God can and God will give us spiritual victory, and we are told that in these pictures when God gave his people political and military victory as well. Asa trusted in God. God gave him the victory. The text says there in chapter 14. And afterward, as we read just a few moments ago from the text in chapter 15, after this happened, the prophet of God goes to Asa, and he cautions Asa. And we need to be cautioned also, by the way, in our times of prosperity, in our times of success. It's easy for us to assume that if things are going right, if God is blessing us, if we don't seem to have any kind of problems right now, well, then that's when we can kind of take our ease and eat, drink, and be merry. And that's not necessarily the case. That may be the very time when we're at our weakest. And the prophet speaks up, and he cautions Asa, continue to search after God. Continue to strive after God. God is going to be found by the people who seek for him. Asa has been seeking for God, so continue to seek for God. This is a lifelong thing. This is not a one-and-done thing. We spend every year, every month, every hour seeking God. And if we do that, like Asa is told to do here, God will allow you to find him. What a wonderful thing that is. The idea that God wants to be found and that he will be found by those who are determined to find him. That's where Asa is, and that's what Asa does, at least in the short term. In chapter 15, we see that Asa does, in fact, commit himself, shows his faith, and redoubles his efforts to serve God at some cost. Maybe the most obvious and horrible cost is mentioned in verse number 16. He also removed Maacah, the mother of King Asa, from position of queen mother because she had made a horrid image as an Asherah, and Asa cut down her horrid image, crushed it, and burned it at the brook Kidron. Now, exactly what it means to remove her from the position of queen mother, the text doesn't say. Exactly how official that position was, what responsibilities it had, what kind of privileges it had, the text doesn't say anything about that. Different cultures are going to differ with regard to the importance of this position. It's mentioned once or twice in the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. Whatever it meant, though, clearly it was important enough to be mentioned. And it was removed from his own mother. Have you ever had an opportunity to chastise your mother about something? How did that go? Was that a comfortable experience for you? I hope that never happens to me. I don't think that's ever happened to me where I had to shake my finger in my mother's face and tell her what for. I can't imagine how that would go. That would be an awful, awful thing to do. Now, sometimes you have to do it. It has been known to happen, and it happens here. Asa's mother was wrong. It was just dead wrong. And she knew better. And Asa chastens her. And that has to have been painful to him. It's got to be. And yet he did it, and perhaps even incurred the wrath of his mother, perhaps even damaged permanently his relationship with his mother. But he did it because it was the right thing to do. Because that's how much he loved the Lord. That's how much he was devoted to the things of God. Brother English's words at the table about devoting ourselves. What a wonderful message that is. Not just for the Lord's table, but for our lives in general. Devoting ourselves to God. Wholeheartedly, even when it comes at very serious expense. But we find in verse number 19, there was no more war. And that seems like a good thing. In the context, that seems to be a positive thing. All of us would rather have no war than war. But when the time came for war, in chapter 16, Asa is a different man than he was before. What happened? Maybe it was the presence of peace. Maybe it was simply because he got used to having what he wanted. Unchallenged. And then when it was challenged suddenly, it had become something that he could not live without. And that he would do absolutely anything to preserve. Our standard of living tends to be that way. I don't know how the economics of your particular family is. None of my business. But I can tell you with the Hammonds family, the way that it works, and I suspect we're not all that too terribly different from everybody else, we have had moments of prosperity, and we've had moments of adversity, and we always manage to pay the bills at the end of the month for the most part. And my dad warned me about this. My dad is not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, but he told me on my way out the door to college, he said, your expenses will expand to meet your income. And I said, well, that sounds like dad talk. And turns out it was. Dad's usually right about such things, and he was right about this too. I have had very, very meager income. I have been well blessed at various times, and my expenditures have always tended very strongly to expand to meet my income. And when you have prosperity, when you're bringing in a lot, and you're spending a lot, and all of a sudden, the things, your income is threatened. And now you're contemplating a life without all these excesses, a life without all of these indulgences. All of a sudden, I don't know about this. How could I possibly survive a cut in my expenses? How could I possibly survive a cut in my income? I think that's a lot of what is going through with Asa here. Asa is used to having comfort. He's used to being unopposed. And when suddenly he's called upon to fight, it blows his mind. He's not ready. And in this hour, instead of trusting in the God that delivered him from a much greater enemy before, he makes a foreign alliance. Now, this is not the same thing necessarily as abandoning the God of heaven, but it's certainly a breach of faith. And that's the way Asa is confronted by the prophet. You should have trusted in God. And very, very generally, there are some exceptions to this, but not very many. When the people of God, the Israelites, made an alliance with a foreign power, it was A, because they didn't trust in God enough, and B, it resulted in a weakening of their connection to God and the influx, oftentimes, of idolatrous influences. Now, Asa did not become an idolater, as far as we can tell. No reason to think that he did. But he also is condemned in the scripture for not trusting in God enough to survive this. Verse 1 of chapter 16 says, in the 36th year of Asa's reign, Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and fortified Ramah in order to prevent anyone from going out or coming into Asa, king of Judah. That is, you're on your own. You're not going to have any foreign alliances to help out. Then Asa brought out silver and gold from the treasuries of the house of the Lord and the king's house and sent to Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, who lived in Damascus, saying, let there be a treaty between you and me as between my father and your father. Behold, I have sent you silver and gold. Go break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me. And by the way, on a side note, what is the deal with us convincing people to break their confidences with other people and make confidences with us instead? This comes up especially with regard to marriage and divorce and remarriage. We have second marriages. I could give you some examples, especially from Hollywood. Women who are just absolutely paranoid about their husbands leaving and absolutely possessive to the point of paranoia over this. And the reason is because they left their first wife to be with her. He's already proven they can break an alliance. And now you're expecting him to be truthful, true to you. That's a side note that I'll throw in there for free. But why is it that you're going to trust in this foreign power and you're going to get him on your side by getting him to break trust with somebody else? What sense does that make? And wouldn't it make a whole lot more sense to ally yourself with the God of heaven who has been your ally throughout your entire life, throughout your entire reign as king, and who cannot possibly fail? But apparently that's not what's on Asa's mind at this particular moment. God is not the one who has changed in this process. God didn't suddenly become inept. He didn't become incompetent. He didn't become powerless. It was Asa who had changed. Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you have relied on the king of Aram, verse 7, and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Aram has escaped out of your hand. That is, this is an enemy you could have defeated. instead of an ally that you wanted to trust in? Were not the Ethiopians and the Lubim an immense army with many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. It's the same God. Do you understand that? And this is a tremendously valid point for us today. When we are having doubts about God's ability to shepherd us through our difficult times. We just sang a song about that, right? The Lord my shepherd is, I shall be well supplied. Since he is mine and I am his, what can I want beside? What a marvelous message that is. Especially given what you know the Lord your God has done for people in the past. This is the God who parted the Red Sea. This is the God who brought down the walls of Jericho, that slew 185,000 Assyrian troops in one night because his people wanted it, because his people asked in faith, because they walked in faith. It's the same God. And that is by no means a guarantee that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and all your enemies are going to be dead. I'm not suggesting that. In fact, I suspect very strongly that that will not happen. That being the case, it's the same God, and our faith should be at least the same faith as their faith. And if not, why not? And if God could deliver his people in times past, why couldn't he deliver us today? Why is he not worthy of our trust today? Maybe it's because we have too much peace. Maybe it's because things are, and especially in the 21st century, especially in the United States of America, things are so good for us. You listening? So strong, so comfortable for us that we cannot conceive of taking a step backward. I grow weary of Christians bemoaning the possibility that one of these days churches might be robbed of their tax-exempt status. That's going to be the end of the world. Surely the Lord will come if we are dealt a blow like that. How dare we make a statement like that? Like that is the worst possible blow that God's people could ever receive. We have taken much, much worse than that in times past. I'm not rooting for worse than that now. Understand? I'm all in favor of comfort. I'm all in favor of peace. But let's not get so comfortable in our peace that we become incapable of waging war. The peace of God that Philippians talks about, that passes all understanding. This is a result. It's not a goal. It is not our objective in life to get to a point where we have peace. That's the wrong way of looking at it. What God is telling you is, you pursue my things. You trust in me. You turn your life over to me. And as a result of that, the peace will come to you. Regardless of the circumstances, regardless of whether the times are good or bad, you will have your peace. Because we're unified in the Spirit, as Paul says there in Ephesians 4 and verse 3, the bond of peace is found in the unity of the Spirit. If we will join together with men and women of faith, trusting in the Lord, devoting ourselves to Him completely, we have the absolute assurance that the peace that we love, the peace that we covet, will in fact be ours. That does not necessarily mean our enemies are going to stop fighting us. In fact, I'll pretty much guarantee it, to some degree at least, they will keep fighting. But you'll have peace in your heart. You'll have peace with God. You'll have peace with other faithful brethren. And you will find that that peace, that harmony, that tranquility of heart is going to be enough not only to continue in the short term, but also to continue in situations where times are rough. When you are called upon to go to war, you will be able to go to war in faith just as you enjoyed your days of peace in faith. Second problem, and the second is like unto it, too much wealth. Again, with 21st century America, I got no problem with having more instead of having less. All things being equal, more is fine. But let's be consistent about this. If the love of money really is the root of all kinds of evil, if we are really supposed to be storing up for ourselves treasures in heaven instead of treasures on the earth, at some point, does that not mean that our pursuit of physical possessions, physical wealth, will be interfering with our walk of faith? Doesn't it have to mean that? The question is not whether money can be a problem. The question is, when will it be a problem? And is it a problem right now? It might very well be that Asa was in a situation where he had too much success. All of this wealth, and wealth generally is measured in silver and gold in this time, especially for kings. All of this wealth that had been provided to him by God, not by himself, not by his army, not by his nation, but by God ultimately. He takes this wealth and he gives it to a foreign power. Without being asked, without having to fight, without losing a battle, he gives it up of his free will. Because he doesn't have enough faith in God. Choosing a foreign ally. Now, it might be that if Asa had been poor at this moment, if this had been a time of depravity, financial depravity, instead of wealth, privation might be a better word than depravity. If this had been a time of shortage, and he had not had the money to go out and hire an ally, maybe he would have been forced by economic means to trust in God. Wouldn't that have been better? If that is, and grant my premise for just the sake of argument. If Asa had been in financial situations where he could not have hired a foreign ally, he would have been more likely to trust in God. If he had trusted in God, things would have gone well for him. Therefore, he was better off, or would have been better off, poor than rich. And how many times does that strike home with us? How many times do we use the blessings that God has given us in a way that weakens us, that whittles away at our commitment to God, rather than honing it? He had given to God from his excess before. Again, the problem is with Asa, it's not with God. In times past, when things were going well in this time of revival, we saw in verse number 11, back in chapter 15, they sacrificed to the Lord that day 700 oxen, 7,000 sheep from the spoil that they had brought. All of this wealth they brought in from attacking and destroying the Ethiopians brought in a massive wealth, this time measured in animals. And he gave of that wealth. I don't know if he gave 10% or 20% or 100%. I don't know what it was exactly. But he found himself prospered at God's hand. And because of that, he gave to God. He honored God. And did so freely and willingly and joyfully. That's the Asa of old. Now, he was doing exactly the opposite. Now he chose of his own free will. He wasn't asked. He did this on his own. He chose to rob his own nation to pay a foreign power. And in so doing, weaken his connection and the nation's connection with the God who supposedly they were trying to serve. What a powerful lesson this is for us. I don't know how much you're prospering from the hand of God at this particular moment, or how you measure up with your neighbors, or how you measure up with me, or with the other folks in the room, or and it's none of my business. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter at all. Whether you made $10 this week, or $1,000, or $10,000, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever you have is a gift of God. In fact, if you didn't prosper at all, and just managed to keep all the money that you'd stashed in your mattress, you're still prospered of God. All of it ultimately is coming from God. And there's no point in having it if we do not glorify God in it. Everything that we have is a gift from God. He is the giver of every good and perfect blessing. And so therefore, everything that we have should be used to his glory. Now, that's not to say we can't use it in self-serving ways at all. I like to eat as much as the next person. I like having a roof over my head. These are perfectly noble and appropriate financial goals. The one who does not provide for his own is worse than an infidel, the text says. But at what point are we providing for ourselves and providing for our own? And at what point are we so paranoid about losing what we have financially, losing what we have physically, that we render ourselves incapable of serving God? God always has to go first. I stole a little bit of my thunder reading verse number 13 in Luke chapter 16. No one can serve two masters. It's true. It's absolutely true. And it is true of things other than money, but money's the easiest application. It's the one that Jesus makes in this context. No one can serve two masters. You're going to be faithful in a little and then faithful in much, or unfaithful in a little and unfaithful in much. How many of us are willing to be faithful in much if God will just let us slide a little bit and allow us to be unfaithful in little for a little bit? I have conversations with college students with regard to this. Young people who are trying to make their way in the world. Haven't yet found out who they are or what they're going to be doing or how much money they're going to be making. And at some point in the very near future, all these bricks are going to fall into place and my life is going to be complete. And at that point, I'm going to have a lot. And I'm going to take from that lot and I'm going to give to God. Well, that's great. I hope and pray that you do. But I'll tell you from my experience, if you find yourself full of excuses for not serving God when you have little, you will have just as many excuses when you have much. There's always a way to not give God his glory. You'll always have that opportunity. It doesn't matter how much or how little you have. And really the best way, maybe the only way, to protect yourself against that kind of thinking is to commit yourself completely and totally while you have little to give to God anyway. Now, I started putting money in the plate when I first started getting an allowance. I don't know how old I was, 10, 12 years old, something like that. My parents taught me if you're prospered, you give. Now, that's not the only way by any means you can contribute to the work of the Lord. Even the only way that you can contribute financially. There are other ways. But that's the most obvious way. And if we are unwilling to give of our means, does that not speak to our faith? Does that not speak to our priorities? Well, when I get the raise, I'll give. Well, that's good. Why don't you give now? Why don't you commit yourself to God now? You are a steward of the things that you have, regardless of how many or how much you happen to have. I would also urge you with regard to this, that money is not the solution that we make it out to be. Kind of flipping it the other side here. Money is rarely, if ever, going to be a solution to a spiritual problem. Money is not spiritual. It's not bad necessarily, but it is carnal. It's physical. And if you have a weakness of faith, if you have a weakness of commitment, that is ultimately a spiritual problem. That is not a financial problem. And the solution to spiritual problems is not better finances. The solution is more spirit, more faith, more commitment to the things of God. In chapter 28 of 2 Chronicles, verse number 19 and following, we have another king named Ahaz, who is a very different man than Asa was. Ahaz makes no pretense of committing himself to God. He is all about finding the foreign alliances, and he connects himself very firmly and very spiritually, in fact, to the pagans, particularly to the Assyrians. The text says in verse number 19, "The Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had brought about a lack of restraint in Judah and was very unfaithful to the Lord. So Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him." This is the one that he trusted, the one he wanted to make an alliance with. Well, he got what he asked for, and he came and made the problem worse instead of making it better. "Although Ahaz took a portion out of the house of the Lord, now the palace of the king and the princes, and gave it to the king of Assyria, it did not help him." How about that? Ahaz finds a solution to his political problem. I'm going to make an alliance with this foreign power. And at the end of his alliance, he's exactly where he was before, except poor. And in fact, even more determined to reject God, even more determined to turn his back on the God of his ancestors. Can we be guilty of the same thing? Can we just think that we can somehow write a check and fix our problems? You may fix your problem with the IRS that way. You may fix your problem with your landlord. may fix your problem with MasterCard people. But that will not address your faith issue. That will not fix your problem with God. We need a spiritual result, a spiritual commitment to a spiritual problem. And thirdly, and maybe most obviously, I think that there is an ego issue at view, in play here. Asa has too much ego. And this has come up a couple of times already in conversation with regard to the kings of Judah. This unwillingness of human beings, and it'd be easy to say men, I'm not convinced the women are a whole lot better than the men are with regard to this, that we don't like to take instruction very much. That we would prefer to think that we've gotten it right. That we are doing okay, that we're doing good enough, that we are just in a lull and we'll work ourselves out of it. That we don't need any help, and we don't need any correction. And people who want to come in and complain about the way we're doing things, they don't understand us, or they're not sympathetic, or they're just as bad as we are, or, you know, whatever kind of excuse we want, that we can come up with in our head to allow us to stay where we are. Ultimately, it is an ego problem. Asa has an opportunity to accept God's solution or come up with his own solution, and it is more interesting to him, more fulfilling for him, to come up with his own solution instead of trusting in God. And we see the same theme coming out over and over again. Gideon with the 300, and on and on we can go. The idea of God saving with few instead of saving with many. Specifically so, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1, I think it's verse 31, he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. Specifically so, there's no way we can possibly take credit for this. There's no way anyone had ever believed that I did this. I have to glorify God, because God's the only one who could possibly take credit for this tremendous victory. We see this story over and over again in the Old Testament. And we ought to be seeing it in our own lives as well. And it ought to be reflecting our own honoring and prioritizing and cherishing of God and his solutions, his instruction, and occasionally his correction. When a prophet comes to Asa and criticizes him, says, no, you're not doing as you did before. You're not doing as you ought to do now. You need to do better. You need to change this. Asa's solution is to put the prophet in prison. Well, he wasn't the last one to try that. And maybe people have treated you that way. When you tried to come to them with some kind of instruction, some kind of help, and you were criticized because of your hypocrisy or because of your lack of love or because of your bad timing or lack of information or whatever it happened to have been. And quite likely it was never said, oh, no, you're mistaken about that. That is actually not true. And here, let me show you that it's not true. It's not a matter of whether it's true or not true. It's a matter of we don't like being criticized. And as much as we resent people not taking our words of criticism properly when we go to them, we're just as bad. Or certainly I'm just as bad. I don't like being criticized either. But I like to think that when it comes down to it, it may take me a few seconds, it may take me a few hours, it may take me a few weeks. But I would like to think that I'm rooted and grounded enough in God's truth where I ultimately care more about doing what God told me to do than appeasing my own sense of self-worth. Ultimately, of course, all of sin falls short of the glory of God. It's not a matter of self-worth anyway. I know I'm not worth anything. Anything that I am worth is because God made me worthwhile. And so therefore, why should I brag? Why should I boast? Why should I protect my own ego? And it got even to the point where, and this seems almost like spite here at the end. And this is a man of God. This is a faithful, devoted servant of God, lifelong servant of God, who got sick in his later years and seems almost deliberately to have avoided talking to God about it. He'll talk to doctors, but he won't talk to God. Why is that? Why is it that adversity, whether it's health, physical health adversity, or whether it's financial, or whatever it happens to be, why is it that when we need God the most, we trust in God the least? Why is it that our connection to God is weakest when we need it to be strongest? We are all in favor of telling people you need to pray, you need to trust in God, work your way through. But then when it's us, when we're the ones who need help, we need healing, we use this as an excuse to not serve God. We don't read our Bibles. We don't pray. We don't come to church services. We do everything that we can to take a ball and hammer to the relationship with the one who actually is in control, not only of our own health, but the universe. Whether we get healthy or not healthy, whether we get rich or not rich in this particular situation, is not the point. The point is God has gift-wrapped us an opportunity to trust in Him, to believe in Him, to hope in Him. What a tragedy it is when we turn that on its head and use it as an opportunity to reject Him, to blame Him, to run from Him. It's the exact opposite of what we need to do. Romans 3, verse 23. We all fall short of the glory of God. All of us sin, absolutely. I would like to think that Christians who love God, who acknowledge their own weaknesses, who certainly understand their own frailties, spiritual frailties, that we would be more than willing, more than eager to listen to correction, whether it comes from the Word, whether it comes from a preacher or an elder or a parent or anybody else, that we want to be corrected. Because being corrected helps us be correct. Repentance, I say this over and over again, repentance is not something you got to do. Repentance is something you get to do. It's an opportunity. It's a blessing. I found out that I'm not right with God. I don't want to be not right with God. I want to be right with God. And because I've been corrected, I had an opportunity to do that. I didn't know that I was running short or running low in my faith. Or maybe I just wanted to turn a blind eye to it. But now I know. And I want to make that right. What a tremendous blessing it is when someone is able to come to us and lift us up and help us find our way once again. If we have enough humility, if we are willing to, as 1 John chapter 1 tells us, confess our sins, we have confidence that He is faithful and just to forgive us. We'll read the text. Verse number 6 of 1 John chapter 1. If we say that we have fellowship with Him and yet walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. We all fall short, He says. But if we walk in the light, as He Himself is in the light, if this is our pattern of behavior, this is what we are, this is how we define ourselves first and foremost, I'm a child of God. If we walk in the light as He Himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, His Son, cleanses us from all sin. Not some sin, not most sin, not the really big sin, all sin. If we say that we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sin, He is faithful and righteous to forgive us of our sin and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. You see, verse number 9 is the contrast to verse number 8. You can either acknowledge that you need help or not acknowledge that you need help. It's one or the other. Confess or don't confess. If you will acknowledge that you need help, if you will confess your sinful state, then you get out of your sinful state. That's kind of the ironic twist in all of this. If you insist on thinking you don't need help, you won't get any help. If you insist that you absolutely need help, you get help. What a wonderful system this is. A few other warnings before we close up here. I want to touch this on this in passing here to show this is not an isolated incident. This is not just Ace. It's not just Ace's family either, by the way. This is a problem that is endemic to the children of God far more often than we would like. Solomon, for instance, did not practice what he preached. Solomon knew better than to marry these foreign women. At one point, he refused to take his foreign wife into any building that had housed the Ark of the Covenant. He was that committed to holy things. That may be a little bit over the top, frankly. But he got over that. And the more attached he got to these foreign women, the more attached he got to their idols, and the weaker and weaker his own faith got. He told his son in Proverbs chapter 5 and in many, many other passages that he needed to listen to his wisdom, including the wisdom with regard to women. And then he goes and violates his own principles. Can a man take fire into his bosom and not be burned? Well, Solomon took a whole bunch of fire into his bosom and he got burned a lot. Why couldn't he even just listen to his own words? Why couldn't he have read his own book? Seemed like it would have worked a whole lot better if he'd done that. Jehoshaphat, a great king, maybe even greater than Asa, one of whom it is not said anything specifically negative. Other than this, he had too much of a fondness for his erring children of God. That may seem like an odd thing to complain about. But Jehoshaphat seems determined to make an alliance with Ahab and Ahab's family, to the point where he marries his son off to Ahab's daughter, cementing this alliance. They go to war together, and he gets a front row seat to how faithless Ahab is. He knows exactly what's going on with Ahab, and for whatever reason, he wants to turn a blind eye to the depravity of the nation of the north. Now, it may seem on the surface like getting along with your brethren is an obvious and undeniable positive thing. That's not necessarily the case. Spiritual partners have to be chosen very carefully. That's why we're told in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14 that you're not supposed to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Now, somebody might say, well, Ahab wasn't an unbeliever, strictly speaking. Well, I don't know. Pretty close to it. Certainly acted. He aspired to be an unbeliever if he wasn't an unbeliever. And how many times do we rationalize an alliance of some sort with someone who claims to acknowledge Jesus Christ, who claims to be a servant of the king, and yet his every action, her every action, denies the word? We need to be very cautious, the bedfellows that we choose for ourselves. Jehoshaphat was warned over and over again. And even after the warning, he still wants to make an alliance with the son of Ahab in this naval effort down in Ezion Geber. His entire navy is destroyed because you insisted on doing what I told you not to do. And it has ripple effects. Jehoshaphat's son is a horrible, horrible man, the grandson of Ahab. And when he dies, his son is just as bad. And when his son dies, his grandmother, Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, actually assumes the throne herself. You can imagine how bad she was. This is all Jehoshaphat's fault. Not because he was a bad man himself, but because he allied himself and he allied his family with spiritual forces of wickedness. And it had ripple effects for generations afterward. Joash. We touched on him a little bit in the previous hour. Joash let his faith die with his mentor. He had a priest, mentor, benefactor named Jehoiada, who was shepherding him through these early days, who helped put him on the throne in the first place, who guided him, taught him right from wrong. And Joash was great, a tremendous force for righteousness, one of the best. And then Jehoiada dies. And Joash goes nuts. We have to make sure that this does not happen. And when I say make sure it doesn't happen, I'm not saying woe be to us if dad dies or granddad dies or the elders die or something. That's not the point. People are going to die. There was no question that Jehoiada was going to die at some point and almost certainly die before Joash did. That was a given. We're not going to be able to keep faithful ones alive in the flesh, not indefinitely at least, but we can keep them alive in the spirit. We can continue to consult this great cloud of witnesses that the text mentions in Hebrews chapter 12 verse 1, and he's talking there about Old Testament faithful ones, but we could just as easily talk about people that we've known, people that we've loved, people in the previous generation or the generation before that, people who've written books, who've given lectures and speeches. People who stood for the truth in difficult times and encouraged others to do the same. That's what we need to be doing for succeeding generations. Taking a public, firm stand for the things of God. And allowing the influences that have influenced us to stay alive. I know the young people get tired of us telling stories. You don't want to hear what my granddad did in such and such a time. I don't blame you. I didn't want to hear it either. But you're going to keep hearing it. At least I certainly hope you do. And young people, you know, relatively young people in your 20s, 30s, or whatever, we like to think that somehow or another we've reinvented the wheel in our generation and that we don't need the help of older people. That's just not true. We need continued influence from those who have gone before, those who are written about in the Scriptures, those who we've known in the flesh. Keeping that influence for righteousness, for godliness, alive in our lives, alive in our hearts, alive in our hands. This is a blessing to us that we absolutely cannot afford to lose. We need desperately to hold on to the things of God, and there are going to be times that come up in our life that are going to try to push us away from God. And if we can have a relationship with somebody, living or dead, that helps us keep to the straight and narrow, why wouldn't we want to do that? Do we not want to strengthen our resolve to do what's right? We know what's right, but we are not always motivated to do what's right. So let's find that motivation while we can. Seek it out. Hold it close so that we can receive correction, so we can receive instruction, and do it in the right attitude and with the right disposition so that we can be stronger in the future than we were in the past. That's how we grow. And that's how we set ourselves up to be mentors to another generation that's going to come after us. There's going to come a time when we'll be held accountable for all these things. The Lord will come and judge us. He's going to judge Asa. He's going to judge all these others that we talked about. He's going to judge us. And in that moment, it's not going to matter quite so much whether we climbed any mountains or swam any rivers or did any other kind of amazing thing. Were you a person of faith or not? That's all that's going to matter. Did you trust in God or not? So trust in God. Turn your life over to Him and trust Him as much as you possibly can, as often as you possibly can. Do not allow yourself any days off. Do not allow yourself weak moments or token vices or any other nonsense that we might want to talk about. Trust in Him in all things. Walk in the light as completely and totally as you possibly can. And in the end, go to heaven when you die. That is the confidence that we have as people of faith. If you need to respond in your faith to the Lord, if you need to make your life right in any way, any spiritual way, including putting Him on in baptism if you have not done so already, if there's something we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.